From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Dr. David Agus about his new book, The End of Illness, and Dr. David Topping from CSIRO, Australia's National Science Agency. He tells us what science has to say about what we eat. Dr. David Agus is a professor of medicine and of engineering at the University of Southern California. I asked him, how does being an engineer affect being a physician?
You know, very easily, is that taking that step back and looking from an engineering perspective. Remember, as a physician, I'm a biologist. I want to understand every signaling pathway, how everything works. Engineers can take that step back and say, a complex emergent system we can control without understanding. And that's a level, and that's a new way of approaching health that I think we have to do.
Well, I think in my case, you know, I say to people like, hey, you drive your car around. Do you really understand how the internal combustion engine works? Do you care?
Right.
You know, change your oil and never look back, you know. So it's sort of the same kind of thing.
And, you know, we think we understand how drugs work in medicine. Most of the drugs, it's just hand waving. We don't really know how they work. We know how they work in a test tube, but how they work in the body in that complex system, we're not really there yet.
Talking about a place that we're not really there yet. We've made so many strides in cancer, and yet in your book I learned, if we look at the death rates from cancer, they've only declined 8% in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It's amazing, and it's a shame. You know, we had dramatic inroads in diseases like heart disease, stroke, infectious disease, and we can talk about why that happened. But in cancer, we've really struck out. There are little wins here and there. We have a great drug for a certain kind of leukemia, but the big cancers, the lung cancers, the breast cancers, the prostate cancers, we haven't made that much of an impact on. Part of it is we try to understand cancer from the ground up, looking at the DNA, how it signals at every step that happens. And what you soon realize is there are levels of complexity we're not going to understand. So we need to focus instead on to control. So to me, cancer is a verb, not a noun. You're cancering. And when you look at it that way, I want to change the body from a cancer state to a health state. Whereas in my field, historically, we've looked to try to shrink that cancer 50%. Well, if you show that to a mathematician, they say that's not even an order of magnitude. And when you're talking of hundreds of billions of cells, a 50% shrinkage, what does it mean, really? I want to change the system, and that's a very different approach to health.
Well, that doesn't answer the question of why the deaths haven't declined. I mean, are we living longer with cancer? Is that part of it?
We're not living much longer with cancer. That's the problem, is that we're looking at the same drugs, trying to figure out how to use them without bringing in new technology, without bringing in a new understanding. Remember, in 1997, a 25-year-old kid came to the best hospitals with germ cell tumor, the brain, the lung, and the liver, and they told him, you ain't going to live. Spend your last 3 months with your family. Instead, he went to Indianapolis and got platinum, the same thing in my wedding band, and a year and a half later won his first of seven Tours de France. And so why did Lance Armstrong get cured by platinum? I don't know. How does platinum work and cure his tumor? I don't know, but it was an observation. Some goofball doc took two platinum electrodes in a gel and said, do cancer cells like electricity or not? And it turned out the platinum killed some of the cells of electricity they didn't care about. And so it was serendipity. And so somehow it changed the system so the cancer didn't want to grow. And what people forget over and over in my space is that if you look under a microscope at breast cancer, for example, a pathologist will look and say, hey, that's breast cancer. They don't care what the genetics are. There are 150 different ways it can evolve to look like breast cancer, but it always looks the same. So somehow the body or evolution is selecting out for phenotype, what things look like, and not the genes. Yet we keep trying to treat and understand the genes. We got to take that step back.
Now, just to finish off on the cancer subject here, I read in your book that as much as 75% of the cancer drug use is off-label.
Yeah, no, it's wild. So I can cure Lance Armstrong's disease, germ cell tumor, with a drug called platinum, yet it's not FDA approved for that indication. I can cure Hodgkin's disease, yet the chemotherapy we use isn't FDA approved for that indication. The way the FDA works is you do safety studies, and then you get approval for one indication. But a doctor can use it for anything.
Once approved, anything.
Once approved, anything. And so what you got to work on is the third-party payers to reimburse for that. But once there are two publications in the literature, they generally do reimburse. So it calls into question a little bit our whole regulatory strategies. Remember, in the 1950s, there was a very clever when the FDA was set up, it was only safety that you had to put in, no efficacy data. And a very clever economist, Gary Becker from the University of Chicago, put out there that if we went back to that, went back to safety only for the FDA and then let third-party payers describe efficacy, we're going to get drugs in the market sooner, we're going to be more efficient and cut drug development costs by hundreds of millions of dollars per drug, which can lower costs for all of us.
Now, I know you're really into prevention. I mean, let's talk about something simple. Let's talk about the London bus studies. What were they?
Oh, it's freaking cool. Is that 1953, there are 26,000 workers in the British Transit Authority. Half of them are the bus drivers that sit 90% of the day and drive the buses, and half are the ticket takers that walk around and took the tickets on their double-decker buses. Well, it turns out both groups weighed the same. They had the same BMI, or body mass index, yet the heart attack rate was 60% less in the ticket takers compared to the bus drivers. And our notion of exercise today is an hour at the gym or an hour with your trainer, an hour with a DVD doing whatever you're going to do. And then you sit the rest of the day. You negate everything you did in the morning. So we can learn so much from these bus drivers. I want people to be ticket takers and not bus drivers. So I looked at myself. I wore one of those little accelerometers I put on my belt, and I realized I was sitting most of the day. So I got one of those phones where I looked like an air traffic controller. And now when I talk on the phone in my office, I walk, I pace, and dramatically cut the time I sit. And that's remarkable for your health. We need to focus on those little things. The lymphatics in your body that control your immune system, there's no muscles in their walls. They're different than arteries. They have no muscles. So it's the rhythmic contraction of the muscles in your legs when you walk that actually make them move around. And so it changes your physiology when you move. You don't need to all the time get your heart rate up or do aerobics. You just need to move.
Well, you know, this is so amazing to me because we have gotten to this point where we're thinking, okay, we have the ticket here. We're going to go to an hour to the gym, or we've got to get the heart rate up to here. Or we've got to do, you know, and it's like they're almost like exercise pills. If you follow this formulation, we just kind of have to go to another perspective from what you're telling me to say, okay, humans were meant to move. That's the healthy state.
You know, question. We evolve into these simple ways of doing things. We all like a prescription, right? Prescription is take three of these pills or take this juice or move around here. And we forget, again, is there data behind it? Is this what we need to do? And things get propagated.
Well, we just finished with all the football seasons and everything that happened there. Half of all NFL players are categorized as obese.
Yeah.
Do they not know about walking around? They're running around in the field.
And then, you know, they also die early. And so it's absolutely dramatic. You know, we did this editorial for CNN during the Super Bowl, and I got hate mail like you wouldn't believe. And I'm not against football, but what we have to do is learn from the fact that many football players die in their 50s and 60s, and we have to change things. We have to have better helmets so they get less inflammation in the brain. We have to promote them for being skinny, not obese. And we have to change how we do things, not get rid of football. But yes, the data are clearly there. People with a large body mass index or obese have many more health problems. People with more inflammation have many more health problems. Well, football players, you know, win on both of those accounts, and we got to change that.
Now, inflammation, you talked about that there.
Yes.
Inflammation is a killer on a lot of levels.
Oh, it's our enemy. Inflammation is the root cause of much of heart disease, cancer, neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, et cetera. And so we need to really focus on inflammation. And we have data there how we can lower inflammation. And that data actually can lead to lower rates of heart disease death and cancer death. And they're rather easy and they're inexpensive. But we need to focus. And they range from behavior changes to environmental changes to drugs. And, you know, when I first started to talk about the drug thing, again, I would get thousands of negative emails. He's a shill for the drug company. He's pushing pills. Well, these drugs I'll tell you about are dollars a year. They are generic. And you can go, you know, for example, statins, which we'll talk about in a minute. You can go to Walmart for $9, get a 90-day supply. I mean, so these are not tremendously costly. And again, I wish we didn't have to do it through pills, but we do. Evolution selects out for who has good kids. It doesn't select out for who lives until their 90s or 100. And so we need to optimize a little bit. So if you start to look at the data, for example, on aspirin, a baby aspirin a day, if you start to take it for 20 years, will reduce the overall rate of cancer by double digits. It'll reduce the death of colon cancer by 55%, the death of prostate cancer by 10%, the death of breast cancer by 15%. And you start to look at this data, and then obviously there's a dramatic effect on cardiovascular disease also with this baby aspirin. It's not for everybody. People who have stomach issues, bleeding issues, clearly shouldn't take it, but it's something to discuss with your doctor. Statins, drugs like Lipitor and a whole other group of these statins, have been shown to lower inflammation. So in fact, if you take someone with a normal cholesterol and put them on a statin, you will delay heart attack and stroke by almost a decade. You'll make people live longer. It's one of the few classes of drug that's been shown to be the case.
Now, are aspirin statins?
No. So aspirin is a separate drug that blocks inflammation.
Right.
Statins are drugs like Lipitor that were developed to lower the bad cholesterol, LDL. But it turns out what they also do is they block inflammation. During the swine flu epidemic a couple years ago, the one thing that protected you from going on a ventilator was being on a statin because of the anti-inflammatory properties. And so statins can reduce the incidence of cancer. And in many studies, that's pretty dramatic and delay heart disease, stroke, et cetera. And so these are dramatic preventive methods. If you look at it, 16.5% of GDP in America, of gross domestic product in America, is healthcare, and that number is growing. The only way we're going to make an impact is if we start to focus on prevention. We're the number one spender in the world, yet we're ranked 32nd in health. So something is missing here, and we need to build a culture of prevention. Why should Medicare pay for someone's heart disease if they didn't take a statin? If they didn't do preventive methods, if they didn't move during the day, if they did smoke? We need to bring in culpability and responsibility for healthcare, which I know is aggressive. But Michael Dell says, listen, I've got 100,000 employees at Dell, and I'm going to charge a different amount for the people who smoke and don't smoke for health insurance. And I think that's great.
Well, we certainly got into policy here.
Yes.
I
apologize, but I can't help it.
An inside organization.
I can't help it.
That's true. That's true. You got the total picture here. But looking at this besides a pill, what kinds of things in our life cause inflammation?
Oh, that's great. And so, you know, things as simple as what shoes you wear make a difference. So if at the end of the day your feet are hurting you, well, that's inflammation. I don't want that. So I want you to wear shoes that at the end of the day your feet don't hurt you. And so my wife gets mad at me. My high heels I have to throw out? And, you know, the answer obviously is moderation, but it's also choose high heels where it doesn't hurt. As much as you can, block that inflammation.
You know the Venn diagram on high heels and feet hurting, the circles don't meet, you know.
Oh, okay. There's got to be ways to do it. There have to be ways to do it. And if you're walking in the house barefoot, look at the pressure on your joints. You walk in the house wearing a pair of slippers that are cushioned, over time that's less pressure. Over days, weeks, months, all that pressure on the joint builds up, and that yields inflammation. So I want you to think about not just today, but tomorrow. The great example of that is the flu shot. So if you skip the flu shot this year, there's no question you would survive. You'd be sick for 5 or 6 days with the flu, and you'd get better. But those 5, 6, 7 days of inflammation will yield increased heart disease and cancer a decade from now. So again, I want people to think not just about today, but also about tomorrow.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Dr. David Agus. He's a professor of medicine and engineering at the Keck School of Medicine and at the Viterbi School of Engineering at the University of Southern California. He's founded such companies as Navigenics and Applied Proteomics and received numerous cancer awards, including the Physician Research Award from the American Cancer Society. He's here today with the End of Illness. Well, with such companies as Navigenics and Applied Proteomics and Oncology.com, mm-hmm. I mean, all your companies here, you sort of are the poster child for what David Baltimore has famously said. He's the Nobel laureate and former Caltech president. He said, modern biology is a science of information. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of these companies are about information.
Yeah, and I love David. I mean, David is one of my role models, has been really a leader in our space. And I certainly believe what he said is that it's all about information. Unless we start to know our enemy and know what we're up against, we're not going to be able to do things efficiently. And so if you look at Navigenics, you spit into a tube, we sequence your DNA, and we tell you what diseases you're likely to get in your lifetime. And it tells you where to focus. You know, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen data on Alzheimer's come out. That's dramatic. So a whole new understanding of this disease, and actually in animal models, the first time ever we've been able to reverse it. So if I can delay the onset of Alzheimer's, and I know about it for myself, and I can do that, I'm going to benefit from these magic pills in the pipeline. So you want to know. You want to know that information. Applied proteomics is that next step, which is looking at the protein. You know, in the book, Danny Hillis, the great technologist, likened it to you're outside of two Chinese restaurants and you look at the ingredient list. They're exactly the same. You then taste the food. One could be great and one could be poor. Well, the ingredient list, that's your DNA. What the food tastes like, that's the proteome. Remember in 1976, if you thought you were pregnant, we would take a tube of blood from you, we inject it into a rabbit. 5 days later, we sacrifice that rabbit and we look at the rabbit's ovaries. If they were large, you were pregnant. And every hospital in the country had a rabbit floor. Well, 1977, Warner Chilcott for $10 came out with a pregnancy test and it transformed the field. Rabbits around the world rejoiced And at the same time, we were able to have a test to say whether or not you were pregnant, and we can tell that real time. Emergency rooms, everybody benefited tremendously, especially the patient. Well, now with new technology, we can actually look at the whole proteome. The cover of the book is a picture of the proteome. And so I liken it like an engineer where you've got inputs. It's what you eat. It's your genetics. It's what you do during the day. And the output's how you feel. Well, that middle state function has historically been hidden. We've never been able to see it. All of a sudden, you look at the cover of the book, that's a picture of that state function. That's a moment in time of all the proteins in the body. And it's powerful. And so I'm honored to be able to have technologies from our laboratory at the university where we can spin out to actually benefit people.
So with the idea that our DNA is sort of our program, when you run that program, it's producing data. That data is the proteins that are in your body. So applied proteomics then can give us a picture of what the proteins look like in our body at that moment in time.
No question. It's this 40 gigabyte image of all the proteins in the body.
And what does that tell us? What do we know from that?
Well, you know what's going on. And so the notion...
Notice if a protein that you needed was missing.
Exactly. But I also just told you, listen, I think people maybe should discuss about aspirins and statins. And I feel bad because that's a one-size-fits-all prescription. I want to get personalized over time. Not everybody should be on an aspirin. Some people have side effects from them. The same true with statins. Well, proteomics gives you the potential of really personalizing things, doing the right thing for the right patient. And instead of diet, again, one size fits all, we're going to start to compartmentalize things and say, listen, you're going to benefit from food that's rich in lycopene. You'll benefit from cold water fish. And we can actually start to personalize things for the individual, which is key going forward.
Now, give me an example. You can look at the whole proteome. You're looking at my proteome.
Yeah.
How do you know by looking at that proteome that I would benefit by taking the baby aspirin or not?
I'll give you a different example. A simple example is that right now, everybody who turns 50 gets a colonoscopy. And that's the routine. Yet 4,000 people in the United States died last year under the age of 50 from colon cancer. And we feel sorry, but the risk-reward curves didn't come together till age 50. So only 16 to 18% of people who should get colonoscopy in our country do get it. But what if you had a blood test for colonic polyps? What if instead of everybody getting a $10,000 procedure that has complications, we said, listen, there's a polyp. You need to have a colonoscopy today. And you also had a quality metric because if that test didn't go away, if the polyp wasn't removed, the GI doctor missed it, it would show up. All of a sudden, you can transform GI health. If we took 100 people and put them on aspirin and followed them for 10 years and said, well, three of them had a side effect of bleeding, I could say what's similar in their proteome, in the proteins in their blood, versus the compared to each other versus the other 97 people, and start to develop a marker for who should and who shouldn't get aspirin.
So the answer is I can't just take one out of nowhere. I have to take a set of proteomes and match it against what happened to be able to provide an answer.
Yes. And then the goal...
So you did answer my question.
Yes, roundabout-wise. But the goal is I want medicine to be iterative. You know, when you search on Google, it's better than your search yesterday. They followed where you go and they improved. I want the same thing to happen. Can you imagine going to your doctor, they prick your finger, they put that blood into a database, a proteomic database, and all the annotations about you, and then you're populating the database and you're getting information back. So you're helping with the cure of your own diseases. You're helping yourself, your children, your grandchildren by your data.
Well, speaking of your children, your grandchildren, everybody in your family, let's get back to everyday life. And you say eat on a regular schedule. What's the science behind that?
Oh, it's the simplest thing in the world, is that if you have your lunch today at noon and tomorrow at 2 o'clock, for 2 hours, your stress hormones go up. And when they go up, your body goes into shutdown mode and says, listen, I got to conserve energy. I may have to flee a lion. And when it does that, metabolism goes down, so you actually can gain weight. Cognitive thinking goes down and exercise performance goes down because your body's saving its energy. Whereas if you eat on a regular schedule, that doesn't happen. So I don't care if you have 2 meals a day or 5 meals a day. The key is the regularity. It's the person who randomly grabs an apple that hurts themselves. Grabbing an apple every day at 3 o'clock, greatest thing in the world. And that goes true also with when you get up, when you go to bed, when you sleep. And the data in terms of athletic performance, cognitive performance, and weight are fantastic. There's a beautiful study published in the last month looking at diabetes. One of the best ways for type 2 diabetes to keep sugar under control, again, is a regular schedule.
And so what our bodies like is an expectation that gets rewarded on time.
Exactly. And so Framingham Heart Study, one of the most protective effects was owning a dog. And we always said, well, the dog relaxes you. If you look at the data, the dog puts you on a regular schedule. You get up in the morning to walk the dog. You come home, you know, early. You don't stay out late because you got to walk that dog. The dog barks when you're a half hour late for lunch and you have your lunch. It works. If you look at CEOs functional to their 90s, the one thing in common is regularity and schedule. It's simple, doesn't cost much, and it works.
And I like how you describe it in the sense that, for me, my body is sitting there almost independent of me going, look, I'm just a body. You got it? You know, I'm doing things. And if you're not eating, I'm figuring something's going wrong. If we're not on a regular schedule, there must be something really going wrong. And so we can call it stress. We can call it all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. We can call it modern life. But it's carving out that regularity that actually keeps your body in ways that don't cause it to have any of this, you know, additional stress on the system
We engineer. And remember, your body, and again, I'm not denigrating any of our bodies, but the problem with our bodies is they care about today, not tomorrow. And so again, they want to keep us healthy to have our progeny, our children, and they're not caring what happens a decade from now. And so we need to focus on that decade from now because we want to go to our 90s or 100.
Now, lots of people who want to live a long time take a lot of dietary supplements, you know, vitamins, minerals, all that good stuff.
Again, that's one of the controversial aspects of the book that I've gotten tens of thousands of emails on, most of them negative.
Vitamin hate mail?
Vitamin hate mail. I got protesters at one of the talks I gave last week. I've never had a protester in my life. It was kind of scary. If a man takes vitamin E, the amount of vitamin E that's in a multivitamin every day for 3 years, his risk of prostate cancer is 17% elevated. And that lasts for 3 to 4 years after stopping the vitamin E. A 17% increase in the most common non-skin cancer in men, that is staggering. If women, 39,000 women looked at, and they looked at women who took vitamins and iron and looked at women who didn't. And actually, the women who took the vitamins were lower body mass index, less diabetes, were actually healthier at the start. They had a higher death rate. Women were given, over 70, a high dose of vitamin D on a yearly basis, and increased rate of fractures by over 20%. Not decrease, increase. And the women's health study, taking calcium and vitamin D every day, didn't affect bone fracture rate. You start to look at these. The government looked at 63 studies with over 500 participants randomized with vitamins and their effect on cancer and heart disease, and no benefit in any study looked at. So I look at this and say, listen, billions of dollars spent, billions of dollars in healthcare spent on the diseases that some of these vitamins cause. You know, there's beautiful data on smokers or former smokers. If you take vitamin E or selenium, you can actually increase the rate of lung cancer in these people, or beta-carotene, I'm sorry, increase the rate of lung cancer in these people by over 20%. I look at this and I say, why are we doing it? You know, I'm the same profession that said, take margarine, not butter, 25 years ago, and we killed millions of people with heart disease. I'm afraid we're doing the same thing here. No data, there's a benefit. And there's clearly data that it can cause harm. So why are we doing it?
I have to say I have a great appreciation from your book for the complexity of the human body, the human system. Lately, in the last few years, people have been saying, I've been diagnosed with a vitamin D deficiency, and so they're putting me on pills. And I'm like, can't you go out in the sun? Can't you go out and get something? And it's like, don't you understand that you could put vitamin D in your body, but all the pathways, all the processes, that if you go and get it in some natural way, you're not accounting for all those things that produce the vitamin D and incorporated it.
Yeah,
in the
it's more complicated even. Remember, 76% of people are, quote, vitamin D deficient in this country.
We just discovered this.
The country of Canada made it illegal to do vitamin D testing because it was up to 11% of their healthcare budget 2 years ago. And so who defined what normal was? I didn't come with an instruction list when I was born. And so, you know, if we really have this epidemic, why is hip fracture rate going down, not up? You know, it's a network. And whenever you take a bolus of something in a pill, you downregulate the receptors and screw up signaling. And we're only measuring vitamin D. We're not measuring its receptor or the ability of its receptor to bind or any of the downstream signaling molecules. When you measure one node of a network, it's somewhat irrelevant. And so I look at this and say, what are we doing? You know, part of it is when you go to a doctor and they just say, listen, I drew a bunch of random labs, everything looks okay, come back in a year, you don't perceive value. You go to a doctor and they tell you, listen, this is low, take this pill. You perceive value. The doctor says, I helped them because I changed something. There's that perception of value bidirectionally. I think that's part of what's happening here, and it scares me.
Well, what I think is incredibly scary is the fresh vegetable versus frozen vegetable debate is still going.
Oh, it's wild. I mean, and it's so simple. Somebody upstairs designed fruits and vegetables that when they're picked, they start to degrade to put the nutrients back in the soil to allow that tree or that plant to grow. And so they literally start degrading
it doesn't know
as
you're
soon
eating
as they're
it.
Picked. Exactly.
It's supposed to fall off the tree.
In
the
Europe,
bush.
They go to this market and they buy whatever's fresh that day. Here, we say, listen, I want asparagus, and it came shipped in from South America, has been sitting on the shelf for 4 days, and has zero nutritional value. I want you to go to the market.
Well, maybe not zero.
Very low nutritional value. Yes.
Much less.
So I want you to go to the market and say, what came in fresh today? And if they don't have what's fresh, or there's nothing local there, get flash frozen. Freezing something within a couple hours of picking, in general, and obviously this is generalities, is better than something that's been sitting there for a few days. I want people to eat real food, not to take pills or to do juices. If you put something in a juice, it degrades literally in milliseconds. The great story, and we put this in the book, and I love it. In 1746, James Lynn was captain of the British Royal Navy, and he beat the French in the Battle of Trafalgar because he had limes on his ship. And his sailors didn't get scurvy, and the French sailors did. And at the end, he wrote a book, and like any good entrepreneur, he wrote at the end, and I happened to sell the extract of lime to prevent scurvy. And when people tried it, it didn't work. So in the textbook of medicine in the 1900s, it's still called scurvy and infectious disease because all that he wrote didn't work. Why? Because as soon as you squeeze that lime, the vitamin C degrades.
So you need to be able to take a chomp out of a lime right then, and then you're
food.
Fine.
It ain't that complex.
You have a series of questions, and it's a pretty long list that says basically, you know, do your own checkup. Let's go there.
There's this old adage, with enough data, error goes away. And I certainly believe that. So take the simple thing of blood pressure. When you go to your doctor every day in the afternoon, they check your blood pressure. It's high, they put you on a pill. Who's ever checked it in the morning when you get up? Who's ever checked it at night when you go to bed? Who's ever checked it when you get off a phone call and you're pissed off? I want you to collect data on yourself in the interval between you going to the doctors. And yes, the book and the website has a 4-page questionnaire where I want you to put all that information down. Things as simple as looking at the hair on your legs and seeing how it changes, looking at your body shape, looking at all these different aspects about you, because you're going to see it on a daily basis and notice the change. And you can go in armed to your doctor. And whether it be 5 minutes, 10, or if you're lucky, 15 minutes with your doctor, you have all that information to discuss with him and her. How many times have we left the office and we go, damn, I wish I mentioned that. Or I forgot to talk about this. Or, you know, I never talked about how my sleep is changing.
Or some of these things I didn't even think about, like your smell, has it been changed or declined in recent years? It's like some of these things were on the list that I never even thought about.
One of the things that happens when mercury level goes up, one of the first things to go is the sense of smell. And so, you know, I want you to take these cues on yourself so you can tell your doctor, and they may say, hey, listen, their smell changed. Let me check this lab or this lab. Let me look at this. I want there to be that bidirectional flow of information. Your body is talking to you every day. I want you to listen.
Well, David, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks for writing the book.
Thank you so much. I mean, the book is aggressive. It's declaratory, but we believe in it.
My guest today is Dr. David Agus. The book is The End of Illness. It's published by the Free Press. A number of human disease conditions are on the rise, colorectal cancer and irritable bowel syndrome among them. I asked Dr. David Topping, a chief research scientist at CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, Australia's national science agency, what are these conditions? Who is developing them?
Conditions such as adult onset diabetes, colorectal cancer, inflammatory bowel disease, other conditions such as arthritis, overweight, are established in affluent westernized countries, but they're also on the rise in countries as diverse as India, the Gulf states in the Middle East, China, as these countries become more affluent. So these are conditions that seem to relate very strongly to what we would call an affluent lifestyle, where people have plenty to eat and maybe also are inactive physically. The population data, the epidemiology, that there are very clearly identifiable lifestyle factors, including dietary components as well as physical activity, etc., which are both protective for these conditions but also may increase risk. And our aim is actually to enable people to continue with their existing lifestyle as far as they can, or existing diets as far as they can, with processed convenience foods that are, if you like, tasty, cheap, economical, whatever, but will be effective in lowering the risk of these conditions.
So the concept that processed foods are like lesser, they've been things have been taken out of them, they're not as good as they were. We could have a separate concept or a new concept for processed food, which says, hey, we can put even better stuff in.
Absolutely. I have no quarrel with the food supply. People are well fed. They're getting most of the nutrients that they need. We believe that there are a couple that may be missing, and those are the ones we're trying to put back. But in general, the food supply is, you know, pretty good. As far as I'm concerned, people aren't starving. There are no overt vitamin deficiencies. Our view is that the food supply just needs to be, kindest thing I can think to say, is adjusted to incorporate what we believe are those elements are missing. One of them, obviously, is the omega-3 fats that you find in fish and other sources, which dietary intakes are low. But we're particularly interested in the dietary fiber element of foods.
So eat your fiber. Is it making a difference?
Absolutely. We can show quite unequivocally, and there are a large number of studies showing that the consumption of fiber, particularly the cereal type fiber, is very effective in promoting regularity, which is a very important issue. And in the long term, this lowers the risk of diverticular disease, which is basically a rupturing or herniation of the large bowel. And there's a very, very nice study out of the United States from the Harvard Medical School showing that. There are other fiber components that assist in lowering cholesterol and in improving glucose control as you eat a meal. The one we're really interested in, or the fiber fractions, are those that feed not you, because you don't digest fiber anyway, but feed your bacteria.
And which bacteria are you talking about?
The bacteria that live in your large bowel. We know that there are about 10 times as many bacteria in the healthy human large bowel as there are cells in the body. You get these bacteria from your mother on passage through the birth canal. And when you adjust to adult foods, they feed on what are called fermentable components, because these bacteria are anaerobic. They ferment, and these fermentable components, the bacteria use for energy, and we salvage some of those components and use them for energy ourselves. The trouble is, in the Western diet, while we have some fibers, the fiber fractions that actually feed these bacteria are missing. So the bugs are basically starving.
You go down the supermarket aisle, it says rich in fiber, rich in... So there's fiber and then there's fiber.
Increasingly, nutritionists are beginning to treat fiber like fats. You know, they used to be just fat, but then there's monounsaturated fat, saturated fat, so on. Fiber overall is a good thing. And there are lots of studies, population studies, showing that eating fiber, just fiber, lowers the risk of a number of conditions. But we're beginning to realize that, as we've said, we're breaking it down. So the soluble type fibers will assist in lowering cholesterol, say. The insoluble fibers, such as found in cereal brands, are very good at promoting regularity. But we're focusing on what are called the fermentable fibers. And one of these is called resistant starch. It's a fraction of starch found normally in starchy foods as eaten traditionally, but now largely absent from the diet. This resistant starch is what we believe is one of the most important fuels, if you like, one of the most important foods for the gut bacteria.
How do you identify that you're taking in this resistant starch?
Well, what we can say is that consumption of resistant starch in modern diets, such as those found in the United States, Australia, compared to low-risk groups, intakes are very low. You'd be lucky probably to get to 2 to 4 grams per person per day. And that's in a very restricted range of foods. Compared to people consuming traditional diet where they were at low risk, you're probably getting 20 to 40 grams. And you probably, as I said, you need 20. So the foods that you can get resistant starch from are relatively limited. Green bananas, whole grains will contain resistant starch. Cooked and cooled starchy foods, like cooked and cooled potato, cooked and cooled grits in the United States, maize corn, cooked and cooled starches in general will provide you with resistant starch, because the cooking makes the starch digestible, but the cooling allows the starch molecules to pack back together, and they then become undigestible by us, because starch is the only polysaccharide we can digest, but the bugs can break it down.
So potato salad's on the menu?
Absolutely.
Really?
Boston baked beans.
Boston baked beans.
Yes.
Oh, this is great. Good news. All those things I took off my menu because I was going to get fat.
Well, that
I need it.
That is a total myth, actually. Carbohydrates, in terms of energy density, carbohydrates are only 4 kilocalories per gram. Fat is 9. Alcohol is 7. So The idea of carbohydrates being fattening is rather, I would say, an outdated one.
So carbohydrates, and there are carbohydrates.
Absolutely.
Just like there's fiber and fiber.
Well, it's we're not trying to make it complicated. Actually, what we're trying to do is make it simpler.
Now, here at CSRO, you've developed something that's called Barley Max. What's that?
Well, we use traditional breeding techniques to raise the resistant starch content of barley. We'd worked out that you need to feed these bugs, but it was rather difficult to do. Modern processing wasn't very effective. There is a particular type of maize corn called high maize, and that's got in it a particular form of starch, which means that it can be used to raise the resistant starch or content of processed foods. Processing of ordinary starchy foods doesn't do all that much. So my colleagues, or our colleagues, in part of CSIRO called Plant Industry, were using barley as a experimental system, is the best way of describing it, to explore the factors that control starch synthesis, the way the plant makes starch. That's very difficult to do in wheat because there are six sets of genes involved. In barley, there's only two. So they were able to, using conventional breeding techniques, raise this amylose fraction, and that, to our delight, resulted in a barley. We evaluated their product. Delight is high in fiber, high in the major types of fiber, and is also high in resistant starch.
And I've seen it on the supermarket shelves here in Australia.
Yeah. We've got, I think we've got now three breakfast cereals. We've got other products coming out. I think it's 12 in total. There's flatbreads, there's conventional breads. We know that consumers like it because we've done human feeding trials, human consumption trials, and the people actually loved it. And it does do the right thing to the bugs, which is to produce the compounds that promote the health of the gut.
Now, even though people are focusing on fiber and they're taking a new interest in baked beans and potato salad, are
only
we all eating enough?
Only one person seems to be, and that seems to be the interviewer.
I see. Well, we'll see about that. Get those cards and letters coming in.
Well, in Australia, we have seen a doubling, at least a doubling, of the consumption of fiber, but it's largely in the form of this insoluble fiber, the cereal fiber. And so we think that this is the reason why Australians are really do not seem to suffer from constipation or lack of regularity, but we think because the fermentation is important in the promotion of large bowel health, that's why our rates of colorectal cancer and other gut diseases, which are not mechanical, if you like, haven't come down. In the United States and parts of Europe, fiber consumption remains staggeringly low, probably about 13 to 14 to 15 grams per person per day. It's interesting because the fiber, as fiber, is low in the black Africans, the Zulus in South Africa, which attracted people's attention. They eat a lot of resistant starch. They have a low rate of colon cancer. Interestingly, black African Americans have very similar diet, except that it's low in resistant starch, and they have, and also higher in animal proteins, but they have one of the highest rates in the world. So, in general,
cancer.
Yeah.
So there's something about this resistant starch.
There is, or there is something about this fermentable carbohydrate, including resistant starch. But in general, populations globally are consuming fibers consumptions or have fiber consumptions well below targets, and also low intakes of fermentable carbohydrates.
So if we were to look across the food nutrition research community globally, there's tremendous interest across the board on figuring out which fibers do what and getting them into humans at sufficient levels.
That is the trick. The presence of fiber in foods is very important for human health. The question is, A, the type of fiber, but B, this critical issue of getting enough. So, you know, you can't take a high fiber capsule, you won't get enough. Of course, we're talking about grams. No matter what the type, you are talking about gram quantities.
So you've got to eat a lot, or a sufficient amount.
Of the food.
How do you figure that out as an individual?
You look at what we would call the NIP, the Nutrition Information Panel.
Right.
And
the food label is what
the food label you'd call it. It's got different names in different countries. But I would point out that resistant starch at the moment doesn't appear on food labels. But you just to get your fiber intake in target figures, just look at the fiber figure. You know, and if you're the target that's recommended is about, on average, 30 grams per person per day. Now, the interesting thing to go back to baked beans is the fiber figure that appears on the nutrition information panel on your food label is half of the fiber that is in a baked bean, because the resistant starch content there is enough to double the fiber content.
Ah, so you're getting more fiber than it says.
Yes. You're either getting less or more. Without being funny. I mean, this is an area you've got to realize this is an area of intense community and public interest. And a lot of it is actually that people have just woken up to it, both in industry and science, as well as in the community.
So try to get to that 30 grams of fiber a day. Stay tuned and figure out which kind of fiber when. It's all unfolding now, and we'll be in the next years, we'll be seeing this discussion really open up.
I hope so, because we are doing this to improve human health, lower the risk of serious diseases. You will, with fiber, achieve immediate or soon benefits in terms of regularity. What's happening with the Barley Max that we talked about is that people with disordered gut function, which is not lack of regularity, are also getting benefits. So the feeding of the microbiota, the feeding of the bacteria, seems to have fairly rapid benefits as well in the short term, as well as in, we hope, in the lowering of disease risk over time.
Dr. David Topping is a chief research scientist at CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization of Australia. More information about this interview is available on the web at technation.com. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
You've been listening to the IT Conversations podcast edition of TechNation with Dr. Moira Gunn. Most editions of TechNation are recorded at the studios of KQED in San Francisco. TechNation is also available on over 200 public radio stations throughout the United States, as well as on Armed Forces Radio. Please check your local listings for time and availability.